For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Closing up 1 Timothy, we're going to be studying chapter 6, verse 3 through 19. I entitled this section, Devastating Effects of Living for Money. This chapter is a little bit negative, as we'll see, but I think that what Paul is confronting here is something that, as a culture, I think we really struggle with a lot. And last week, as we looked at chapter 5, as Dennis probably pointed out, he alluded to the fact that God has given us money, the resources that we have, and that has been given to us as a stewardship in order to help out those who are poor. And so that's the positive side of money. And this chapter is kind of the negative side of having money and possessions. Let's begin in verse 6. Godliness with contentment is great gain, Paul says to Timothy. Of course, he's alluding probably to chapter 4, verse 8, where he said that those who attain godliness will be able to find things of value, not only for this life, but also for the next. And so he's contrasting this with the verse previous to this, where he says that those who are, the false teachers in Ephesus are trying to use godliness as a way to gain money. And so he kind of flips that on its head and says, but godliness with contentment is great gain. So he says that it's godliness with this contentment with the stuff that we have. I think what's interesting is that this word contentment in Greek is the word autarkeia, which this actually was the word that was used by the Stoics of this time in the first century to describe the way that we should be viewing money, that we should resist it, that that's not the thing that's going to make us happy. But Paul uses this in a completely different way than the Stoics. For example, the same word is used in Philippians 4, verse 12, when he says, I've learned the secret of becoming content, same word, in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. So, unlike the Stoics, it's not that we look inward in order to find this contentment, but instead this secret that he's talking about, where one can actually be content with what you have, is explained to us in verse 13, that is, I can do everything through him who gives me strength. And so it's not about self-will. It's not about trying to deprive ourselves and having self-discipline. Instead, it's God who gives us this sense of contentment. He goes on in verse 7 and 8, for we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. So, first of all, he says, we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. It's just a simple observation. You don't have to be a deep philosopher to know that there is a beginning and an end to your life. And what he's probably alluding to here is the Old Testament passage in the book of Job, where Job is talking to his comforters and he says, naked did I come out of my mother's womb, and naked will I leave this world. And so Paul is pointing out that even in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, there is a recognition that living for material things is kind of a foolish thing. This is what John Stott said. He says, so our life is a brief pilgrimage between two moments of nakedness. Probably with some nakedness in between, too. You think about a famous story like John D. Rockefeller, who was a famous wealthy man, first billionaire in our country. And apparently at his funeral, this woman asked this guy, said, how much did he leave behind? And the guy was pretty apt. He said, he left everything. And that's certainly true for all of us, that, you know, the things that we accumulate in this life, that we gain a sense of security from, in the end, we're not going to be able to take it with us. You know, one way to maybe think about this is, imagine if you were living at the time of the Civil War, but you were a northerner living in the southern states at the time. And maybe you made a fortune in the Confederate territory. But you know that at some time in the near future that the people in the South are going to lose. And so what are you going to do? Any smart business person knows that they should take their money, they should cash it out, and they should invest it into the northern currency. And so likewise, when we look at our lives, we're sort of passing by in this life. And we can use the resources and the money that God has given to us, and that we can actually invest it into eternal things where we know that it won't be taken away. And so that's the reason why around here what we talk about is investing in relationships, not only in your relationship with God, but also in your relationship with people. Because we know that those are the two things that are going to be able to endure this life. He says, but if we have food and clothing, we should be content with that. So he focuses on the fact that these people, who, although they're poor, are not destitute. That is, they're not deprived of the basic necessities of life. And so he points to food and clothing, which the word for clothing literally means that which serves as a cover. So this is understood broadly, not only as what you wear, but also probably your shelter as well. And so he's referring to the three basic things that we need to live: food, clothing, and shelter. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, is that all that we're permitted to have? Is that what Paul's suggesting? I think that what he's saying here is that he's not trying to give us a maximum for what we should have, but a minimum that we need in order to be content. That we need to be able to differentiate our needs from our wants. You know, in our culture today, those things are indistinguishable. I need my phone. Where is it? You know, obviously having a phone is going to help you function in life, but it's not a necessity. I think that we live in a culture where, because we are awash in wealth, that we start to blend those two categories. And Paul's saying you need to be focused on what you have, and realizing that you should be content with the necessities, that God is going to take care of those things. He says in verse 9, people who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. Okay, so he starts to use some pretty scathing language here to talk about people who want to get rich. Now, we should be careful here and understand that what he's talking about here is the desire to become rich. And I think what he's really describing here is what we would call materialism. Okay, you may not be familiar with that term, but materialism can be broadly defined as a philosophy, that is, a theory that physical matter is the only reality and that everything can be explained in terms of matter and physical phenomena. I think this is from the Oxford Dictionary. The alternate definition would be a theory or attitude that physical well-being and worldly possessions constitute the greatest good and highest value in life, which I think is interesting. And three, the preoccupation with or emphasis on material objects, comforts, and considerations as opposed to spiritual or intellectual values. Now, what we need to consider is that this is a philosophical worldview. You know, somebody who is an atheistic naturalist is by definition a materialist, in that they only believe that what we see, what we can touch, what we can sense, that that's reality. That there is no such thing as the supernatural. There is no such thing as the metaphysical. And so by definition, the only thing that really matters is the here and now, because once we die, we're not going anywhere except for into the ground. And so it makes sense that if you hold that kind of worldview, that you would live for comfort and pleasure and the avoidance of suffering. I think what's ironic is that in our culture today, the predominant number of people in our culture believe that some sort of God exists. And many people actually associate themselves with Christianity, that they view themselves as Christian. And yet when you look at their lives, there's really nothing to suggest that they believe in God or that they have Christian faith. They're living as though they're materialists. They're living as though God does not exist. They're functional atheists. And sadly, I think many Christians today fall into that category who are so-called committed followers of Christ. Even though they talk about how God is the major value in their lives that drive everything, you look at the way that they live and it's contrary to that. It's clear that money and possessions are what drive their life. He says also that people who want to get rich are going to fall into temptation and a trap. Most certainly what he's talking about here is the fact that there is an enemy, God's enemy, who's seeking to try to destroy our faith. The Bible teaches that the evil one, God's enemy, is constantly trying to seduce us and to erode our faith in order to distract us from God. That's especially true if we don't know God. What he wants to do is he wants to keep us focused, fixated on the things of this world so that we'll never actually ask the bigger questions, such as, where do I go when I die? And for believers, I think what he wants to try to do is neutralize us from ever being effective for him. And so materialism is one of the greatest temptations and traps that the evil one has set in place for believers. Also, he says that people who want to get rich fall into many foolish and harmful desires. You know, think about people who not just fall into greed and this continual thirst for more things, but also develop addictions, develop problems in their lives as a result of this desire to become rich, as a result of materialism. And finally, he says, it's these people who want to get rich are going to plunge themselves into ruin and destruction. And the language that he's using here is being thrown into some water and drowning, plunged into destruction. Now, I think, you know, one of the things that we need to consider here is that, you know, materialism causes profound unhappiness. Sometimes you'll talk to people and you'll be like, you know, what do you want to do with your life? And they say, well, I just want to like become rich and be happy. And I always tell them, well, you obviously don't know any rich people, do you? Because a lot of the rich people I know, they're not that happy. Think about some of the richest people in the world. We mentioned John D. Rockefeller, who was the co-founder of Standard Oil, first billionaire tycoon in America. And he says, I've made many millions, but they've brought me no happiness. Or think about Andrew Carnegie, who started Carnegie Steel. Says millionaires seldom smile. And of course, at that time, being a millionaire was the equivalent of being a billionaire. So these are the people who had the most amount of money in their culture, and yet still they felt a sense that they were unhappy. We know, too, that at a certain point, there is kind of a diminishing return when it comes to the happiness that we gain from our wealth. Richard Ryan and Edward Deci, who published an article in the Annual Review of Psychology, these guys are professors at the University of Rochester, and they argue that at a certain point, our level of satisfaction and well-being actually doesn't grow with the wealth that we have. They say the more people focus on financial and materialistic goals, the lower their well-being. Money does not appear to be a reliable route to either happiness or well-being. And they're talking about the sense of fulfillment and happiness that one gets when they're psychologically sound. There appear to be many risks to poverty, but few benefits to wealth when it comes to well-being. In another study by Daniel Kahneman and Angus Deaton, these are professors of economics and psychology, respectively, at Princeton University, and they published an article on the well-being of those who have wealth. And they point out that emotional well-being rises with log income, but there is no further progress beyond an annual income of $75,000. That having a little bit more money when you're impoverished can actually improve your sense of well-being, but at a certain point, it doesn't change it at all. Also, we know that materialism ruins families. I mean, there are some really stunning statistics on how materialism can destroy families. There's a book that came out a number of years ago, and they continually update this. It's called Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic, which is kind of a play on words, using the word affluent and influenza, like it's a disease that's kind of making its way throughout America. And they point out that Americans spend 6 hours a week shopping and only 40 minutes a week playing with their kids. I mean, think about that. 40 minutes a week. Also, we're told that family counselors report that arguments about money are precipitating factors in 90% of divorce cases. Many of us in this room have grown up in a divorced or broken home and can remember our parents arguing when we were younger, and one of the major arguments they used to have was about money. Of course, we don't need statistics in order to tell us how materialism can destroy our family. You know, many of us grew up in a home where our parents weren't around because they were chasing the dollar. And when they were around, they gave you kind of the scraps of their time, devoting most of their best hours of the day to their career, making their money. A few weeks ago, my parents came over, and my son was being crazy. You know, he was running around, bossing people around. He's like kind of like a mini-me. And my parents were there, and I asked him, I was like, do you remember me being like this, like bossy and demanding, you know, at this age? And they kind of looked at me, and they were sort of confused. And they were like, well, it's hard to say, you know, from when you were very little, you were in daycare, and by the time we would pick you home up at night, or pick you up at night, we would take you home, and you'd have to go to bed right away, and I just can't even recall. I just thought to myself, that fits with my recollection of most of my childhood, my parents, that they were busy working all the time. And the thing is that I had practically everything that I ever wanted, but the one thing that I wanted most, I couldn't have, time with them. And a lot of us grew up in a home just like that. Many of us feel that sense that there's something missing, that we long for love, in part because our parents were out chasing the dollar instead of giving us the time and affection that we needed. He goes on in verse 10, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and have pierced themselves with many griefs. Wow, I mean, the language that he's using here is vivid. You know, imagine taking a chef knife, an 8-inch chef knife, and just, you know, stabbing yourself through over and over again. He's saying that those who are chasing after money, that they've pierced themselves with many griefs. And he says, you know, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. You sometimes hear a similar saying in our culture, which is that money is the root of all evil. That's not what Paul says here. He says it's the root of all kinds of evil. That greed, the desire to become rich and to have lots of possessions, has actually caused people to become jealous, to steal. It's been the cause of murder, war. And so this desire, this drive to have all this money can lead into all kinds of evil. And he says these people have wandered away from the faith and have pierced themselves with many griefs. And so Paul's pointing out that ultimately the reason that we need to reject materialism is because it can actually damage our spiritual life. You know, one thing is that materialism can become a false substitute for God. That we have essentially taken God out of the picture at the center of our lives and instead have replaced money and possessions and the pursuit of those things at the center. I like how A.W. Tozer puts it. He says, before the Lord God made man upon the earth, he first prepared him for a world of useful and pleasant things for his sustenance and delight. They were made for man's use, but they were meant always to be external to the man and subservient to him. In the deep heart of the man was a shrine where none but God was worthy to come. Our woes, of course, began when God was forced out of his central shrine and things were allowed to enter. Men have now by nature no peace within their hearts, for God is crowned there no longer. But there in the moral dusk, stubborn, aggressive usurpers fight among themselves for the first place on the throne. This is not a mere metaphor, but an accurate analysis of our real spiritual trouble. There is within the human heart a tough, fibrous root of fallen life whose nature is to possess, always to possess. The pronouns my and mine look innocent enough in print, but their constant and universal use is significant. They express the real nature of man better than 1,000 volumes of theology ever could. They are verbal symptoms of our deep disease. The roots of our hearts have grown down deep into things, and we dare not pull up one root lest we die. Things have become a necessity to us, a development never originally intended. God's gift now takes the place of God himself, and the whole course of nature is upset by this monstrous substitution. Wow. I mean, that is a vivid way of putting it, but I think nails it right on the head. That this sense that we have in our lives that something is missing, what Blaise Pascal calls the infinite vacuum in our hearts, was never meant to be filled with things that are external to us, like our money or our possessions, but only God can fill that. And no wonder we feel a sense of disappointment. You know, each time we think to ourselves, if I can only have this thing, if I can only buy this thing, if I can only have this amount of financial security, then I'll be happy. Then I'll be content. And then we finally obtain it. What happens? There's a sense that something's still missing. A low-grade sense that we desire something else. And yet we fool ourselves into thinking that maybe it's just that we need more. That's the nature of materialism. Secondly, materialism can ravage your spiritual life. What about Proverbs 30, verse 7 through 9? Two things I ask of you, do not refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, that I may not be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? What's he saying there? I pray that you give me enough to be able to survive, but not too much, lest I deny you and say, who is the Lord? You know, a lot of us are like, well, I don't want to become rich or anything like that. But many of us are pursuing degrees or careers that are going to make us riches after we graduate. You know, we would never think that going out and being a pimp or a prostitute or, you know, somebody who sets up a Ponzi scheme is going to be good for our spiritual life. But have you ever considered that going into a career field that's going to make you a lot of money could be dangerous to your spiritual life and your health? What about Revelation 3, verse 15 through 17, where Jesus says, I know your deeds, that you're neither hot nor cold. I wish you were either one or the other. So because you are lukewarm, neither hot or cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. You say I'm rich, that I've acquired wealth and don't even need a thing. but you don't realize that you're wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. That's the effect of having this materialistic outlook, is that you start to fool yourself that you're doing okay spiritually, that you're fine, that you don't need anything. But the fact is that we're still helpless, even though our materialism masks that. I like how John Steinbeck puts it. He says, "A strange species we are. We can stand anything that God and nature can throw at us, save only plenty. If I wanted to destroy a nation, I would give it too much, and I would have it on its knees, miserable, greedy, and sick." Joseph Sand, the famous pastor of Romania who lived during the Iron Curtain, or in the Iron Curtain, said, "In my experience, 95% of believers who face the test of persecution pass it, while 95% who face the test of prosperity fail it." And so there's a danger here that materialism can ravage your spiritual life. It can destroy your intimacy with God. And finally, materialism spawns independence and self-sufficiency, which are deadly to our faith. You know, when you've got your whole life covered, you know, because you've got the money in the bank, that you have financial security, there's often no need to turn to God and ask for Him to help you out. And it's real easy, I think, to get to a place in our lives financially where we're so set that we have no need. And it's easy in that place to feel like we have our lives under control. And we're self-deceived when we're in that place. I was thinking about this recently. My wife and I went to a financial advisor who actually is one of the elders in our church. So he's sensitive to the fact that we want to be generous with our money and also try to live a little bit simply. And so we sat down with him, and he gave some really great advice about how we should look at our finances and maybe areas that we need to like tighten up a little bit so that we're, you know, able to be a little bit more generous, have a little bit more money for our family. And I remember walking out of that meeting and thinking to myself, you know, my primary goal going into this was that I wanted to get to a place where my finances kind of disappear into the background. Because if you're anything like me, thinking about your money and your bills, it's stressful. And I feel like it just takes away from like the energy and thought that I want to put into serving God. But then I started to think to myself, okay, is it ever good to get to the place financially where you don't even think about your money or your needs at all? What about when Jesus said that we should pray for our daily bread? It'd be pretty hard to pray for your daily bread when you own the bakery, when you have all that you need. And so I think that there's something good about that. I think there's something good about being in a place of need, being in a place financially where we're stretching ourselves in a way self-sacrificially to give and trusting that God is going to take care of maybe the shortfall there. Now, a few points that we need to consider here. Because anytime you start talking about this, people are like, well, are you saying that being rich is wrong? Not necessarily. First of all, you don't have to be rich to be a materialist. Let's get that straight. There are plenty of people who are poor who are materialists at heart. I remember going to Cambodia, one of the poorest nations maybe in the world, and I was just stunned by the level of grinding poverty that I was seeing. And I talked to one of the leaders there who, you know, has been there for 20, 25 years serving there. And I asked her, I said, so what do you think is one of the major challenges that you run into with a lot of the people that you're trying to help out here, the Cambodians? And she said, oh, that's easy. Materialism. And my jaw just dropped to the ground. I said, materialism? And I realized materialism is not a matter of how much money you have, it's a state of mind. It's the pursuit and desire for more and more stuff, a lack of contentment. Secondly, not all rich people are materialistic. I know people who are extremely wealthy, who have a great perspective about their money and their possessions. They realize that God is the number one priority and my stuff doesn't matter. And they give generously. And I think that's awesome. But I'll tell you what, I wouldn't want to trade places with them. Because I know that having lots of money is a lot of temptation. And so even though being rich isn't wrong, there's certainly a danger there. Now Paul turns then to those who are rich. So he's talking to the poor who weren't destitute. You know, they had their basic needs and requirements met. But now he turns to those who are rich. He says, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to instead put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. So he says, the rich, they should not become arrogant. Yeah, that's one of the symptoms of being rich, is that it's easy to start to feel like you're better than people. You start to look down on people. You start to think that people should pay attention to you because of the money that you have, that you should be treated differently. He says they shouldn't be arrogant. Secondly, he says they shouldn't put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain. Again, he hits on the fact that one of the real problems with living for your possessions, your wealth, is the fact that it's uncertain, that it could be taken away from you at any moment. You know, having lots of money and stuff causes a lot of anxiety. It's one reason why we shouldn't want a ton of things. You know, this doctor, Richard Swenson, who's cited in Affluenza, said that he was treating his patients, and he noticed that there was a common trend where a lot of them were coming up with these headaches and lower back aches and a bunch of symptoms that he couldn't quite figure out. And he realized that what they were suffering from is what he calls possession overload. He says possession overload is the kind of problem where you have so many things that you find your life is being taken up by maintaining and caring for things instead of people. Everything I own owns me. There is an addictive quality in consumerism, but it simply doesn't work. Yeah, I mean, you know, as you get more and more stuff, the more and more anxiety you start to feel because you got to take care and maintain that stuff. I think about when my wife and I first got married. You know, we had this apartment, one-bedroom apartment down on Longview, right next to Cornerstone Deli, and it was awesome. You know, it was cheap rent, $525 a month. Anytime something got messed up, you know, we would call the landlord. He'd come over and fix it. I guess the only setback or bad thing about it is that, you know, during the summertime, we'd open up our windows and the exhaust fan of Cornerstone would start blowing into our window. So, you know, our house always smelled like shrimp tempura and sesame seed oil. But then when we bought our house, everything changed. You know, you had to pay for things when they broke. You had to mow the lawn, which I hate. You had to maintain your house, and it was like you had to leave. You know, if you had to leave on vacation, you had to think about, oh man, I hope my house doesn't get messed up. And so everything changed. You started to think about it. You know, it started to create anxiety. He goes on to say they've gotten all these things and they still find this emptiness, this hollowness. All they have is stress and exhaustion and burnout, and their relationships are vaporizing. They're surrounded by all kinds of fun toys, but the meaning is all gone. Tragedy is wanting something badly, getting it, and finding that it's empty. You know, the second thing is that when it comes to having lots of stuff, that the things that you own may actually eventually end up owning you. Yeah, that can happen where, you know, when you start amassing more and more and more stuff, it starts to consume you. You can't think about anything else. You got to maintain that stuff. You got to buy new stuff. You know, the more things that you own, the more you have to worry about. This is what Randy Alcorn says in his book, money, possessions, and eternity. He says the greater the mass, the greater the hold that mass exerts. This explains why the largest planets are capable of holding so many satellites in orbit. Similarly, the most more things that we own, the greater their total mass, the more they grip us, hold us, and set us in orbit around them. Finally, like a black hole, a gargantuan cosmic vacuum cleaner, they mercilessly suck us into themselves until we become indistinguishable from our things. Surrendering ourselves to the inhumane gods that we have idolized, this is the final end of materialism. And that's one of the reasons why Paul says that we shouldn't live our lives for our wealth, because in the end it's so uncertain. When it's taken away, it can destroy us. Thirdly, amassing wealth is ultimately a futile exercise. You know, Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10 through 15 says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. There is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by the owner to his hurt. And as he had come naked from his mother's womb, so he will return as he came. He will carry nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand." And so he's saying, you know, the real tragedy is that people who live their lives for their money and their possessions ultimately are not going to be able to take it with them. You know, think about the parable of the rich fool that Jesus tells. He says this landowner was very wealthy, had all this grain. And he looked at his barns. They were able to hold his grain. He says, you know, I want to build bigger barns. That way I can store all of my grain. And so he tore down his barns. He built new barns and filled it up with all of his grain. He said to himself, "Self, you know you're real rich when you can refer to yourself in the third person like that and speak to yourself." He says, "Self, you have many riches laid up for the future." He says, "Now you should drink, eat, and be merry." And then we're told that God came to him in the night and he said, "You fool." He says, "This very night your life is demanded of you. Now who's going to take all of the things that you've stored up for yourself?" You know, when you look at this guy, he was making a good and reasonable financial investment. He wanted to make sure that he had barns to be able to store up his investment so it wouldn't spoil. But the one calculation that he missed is the fact that his life was going to end that very night. And for many of us, we're living as though our lives are going to go on forever. That there is no other life beyond this. You know, I was talking to my friend a number of years ago, and he was expressing to me just how sad he was that his dad had tragically died a few days earlier. We were sitting there just consoling him. He said, you know, it was sudden, it was a heart attack, and so I'm glad that he didn't go through pain. And he said, you know, the thing that was so weird about it was that he, toward the end of his life, was just so obsessed with retirement. Anytime you talk to him, he was just talking about his retirement and how much money he had and his goals. He says, you know, the really tragic thing about it is that he died days before he retired. He never got to see any of that. How many of us are pursuing a life where we're storing up this treasure for the future and yet not realizing that in a moment our lives can be taken from us? That's a bad investment. Now, some of you might be thinking to yourself, well, yeah, I mean, the rich, yeah, it's messed up. But I'm not rich. Well, you might feel that way. But one thing to consider here is that in 2014, the median household income in America was $51,939. So if you grew up in a family, let's say, that had an annual income of that, then you are roughly middle class, okay? But when you think about this maybe from a broader scale, you need to consider the rest of the world, okay? You're middle class compared to the rest of the people in America. But when we broaden our parameters to include then the entire world, the picture looks a little bit different. If you grew up with a median household income right around $51,000, you are in the top 1% richest people in the world by income. You know, some of us have never been to the third world. We've never seen real poverty. You know, some of us might be like, well, I mean, I've seen poverty in America. The poverty line in America is about $23,850 for a family of four, which is pretty low. But again, when you take that and compare it to the rest of the world, even people at the poverty line still are within the top 3% of the richest people in the world. That's stunning to a lot of us. The poorest person in America is still one of the richest people in America, or in the world. You know, according to Richard Sachs in his book called An End to Poverty, the common international poverty line is roughly $1 a day. The World Bank in 2008 revised this figure to about $1.25, factoring in purchasing power parity. And that is, there are adjustments that can be made where, you know, a dollar in America is adjusted to whatever the equivalent would be in Bangladesh, and that same purchasing power will buy you the market value of, let's say, a pound of rice. And so we're talking about real purchasing power, that there are people in the world who live on about $1.25 a day. And to give you at least an anecdote about this, I remember going to Cambodia a few years ago, and I was talking to my translator, and I asked him, I said, so what were you doing before you were translating for World Relief? And he said, well, I was doing construction work. I said, well, how much money were you making doing that? And he said, about $1 a day. And, you know, he was making at that time about $10 a day translating, and he was, like, considered pretty wealthy compared to the people that he was around. Now, some of you are like, well, I'm a poor college student. I'm making well below the poverty line. Okay, you know, imagine you're working part-time as a college student. $10 an hour, maybe let's say working 20 hours a week. You're a hardworking person. And so that calculates to about $10,400 a year. I mean, well below the poverty line. You know, I'm eating ramen noodles. I'm stealing, like, you know, five-day-old Hound Dog's pizza from my roommates just to get by. You know, I'm poor. But one thing you need to consider here is that you're also getting a college education. So the same $10,000 annual income in Mexico City of a poor person who doesn't have the opportunities that you do should be compared to your ability to go to college, work part-time, make $10,000, and then also, in addition to that, pay $10,000 a year for your education. So really, you're making $20,000 a year if you add that in there. So let's just face it, you're rich. You know, don't look to the other people over there, the one percenters. You are the 1%. I'm the 1%. We're rich. We just need to face it. You know, when Paul is talking about the rich of this world, he's talking about us. And we just need to face that fact. Well, he goes on to give us some positive instruction. He says, command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. And so he says, you know, instead of amassing more and more and more wealth, he says, instead, be rich in good deeds. Don't focus on living for money, but focus on trying to serve God and serve people. That's the thing that's going to really make you happy in life. You know, you think about people who, you know, worked hard all their life, who are rich beyond comparison. You know, looking back on their lives, do they typically say, man, I just wish that I could have made more money? Now, most of the time, their biggest regret is that they wish that they would have spent more time with their family. Those who are believers wish that they would have spent more time serving God and less time living for self. And he says, command them to be generous and be willing to share. And so one of the keys to breaking the grip of materialism that I think affects us all is to be generous. You know, 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9 tells us, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich." Our basis for being generous is the fact that our God, the eternal God, saw that we are racking up a moral debt because of our wrongdoing. And in his love and in his generosity, decided to set aside his authority to take on humanity and to come down and pay the price that we deserve to pay ourselves by dying on the cross. That's the message of the Bible. It's the main message that Jesus loves you and he's given to you generously. And the Bible says that if we turn to him and ask for this forgiveness to apply to us, that we can have forgiveness and a relationship with him free of charge. And that then becomes the motivation. When we reflect on the outpouring of love and generosity that God has given to us through Jesus, it nearly compels us to be generous to those who are in need. He says in verse 19, "In this way they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly in them." And so he's saying what the rich need to do is they need to invest in the next life where there are going to be true dividends. You know, our reward are going to be people who made it because of us. If we invest our money, God can multiply that and powerfully use it in people's lives. And they're going to be people that we meet in the next life that we've never met before. We're going to say, it was partly your contribution. That's the reason why I'm here. This is what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 19 and 20. He says, "For that which is our hope, our joy, our crown, in which we will glory in the presence of our Lord Jesus when he comes, is it not you? Indeed, you are our glory and our joy." That's the way to invest in something that's going to last forever. Investing in people. Being generous. Not living for our money and possessions here, because that's going to get ripped away from us when we die. You know, really from a purely pragmatic level, giving to God's cause is really the smartest investment that you could make. God says that when you invest in heavenly things, that he's going to give back to you tenfold. I'm not sure what tenfold is, but that sounds like a lot. Sounds like a good investment. And so when we put our resources and our money into God's hand, he promises that he's going to multiply that. And he's a generous God, so he's going to lavish us with rewards in the next life. Also, I think this implies that we should resist and replace. That's the way to break the grip of materialism in our life. First of all, we need to turn to God and admit that we are living a materialistic way of life and that we want to break that cycle, that pattern. But secondly, we need to also be generous. This is what Jesus says in Matthew 6, verse 21, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. One way to look at this is that wherever you invest your money is where your priorities or where your heart lies. But another way to look at this is that where you invest your money, your heart will move in that same direction. You know, anytime you've invested in something that's really like important, like time or resources or like a project that you're really throwing your heart into, when that doesn't work out, it's devastating, right? Why? Because you've invested so much into that. And so likewise, when you start to invest in the things of God, You start to invest in His purposes. What happens? Your heart naturally starts to adopt those purposes and values as well. It changes you. So for some of us, that's the first step. Taking the step of being sacrificial in our generosity. And it's amazing how God will change your life. I know some of you are like, man, Conrad's being super harsh tonight. Maybe he didn't drink coffee this morning. Maybe he's hangry, just needs to chill. But I have to say that, I am a repentant materialist. This is one of the major struggles in my life. I continue to struggle with it to this very day. And I think the thing that really broke through in on me that this is wrong was, first of all, visiting people who are living these impoverished lives. But secondly, giving generously changed me. And God can change you too. Also, we need to live simply. Some of us are convinced already that being a materialist is wrong. Living for money and the pursuit of money is wrong. But you can be somebody who rejects materialism and still live extravagantly. I think that as somebody who is trying to live for God, that trying to cut down on the excess in our lives is going to provide more and more resources in order to invest in the things that really matter. And so, me and my wife, we really get off on that, trying to find new ways, new cheap ways to get a little bit more money and try to squeeze a little bit of more juice out of our finances in order to give generously. And we're not doing this like as ascetics or anything like that, where we're like, beating ourselves up and going hungry, but it's kind of like a game. It's fun. I've got schemes where like I'm showing up to the gas pump at Giant Eagle, I'm busting out my 5-gallon tanks, three of them, and I'm saving like $130 on gas. And the people are just like, what is wrong with this guy? Hope he doesn't spill any on the ground. But it's cool because we can use that money and invest it in things that really do matter. And finally, live for something that's gonna endure. That's really what this is about. Live for the things of God. Live for people. That's the thing that's going to make you happy in this life, and it's the thing that's going to give you eternal rewards in the next.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.